Hey everyone, welcome to the 268th episode of the Internet of Things podcast. This is your host, Stacey Higginbotham, and your co-host,
Kevin Toefel.
And we have a stupendous show for you today. We're going to be talking about Winx subscription, and then it's still later subscription, and we're also going to be talking about the new Nest Aware subscriptions. It's just a subscription kind of show. We've got lots of little news from companies such as Google Sidewalk shutting down, Google putting out a new skill. We've got news from Wise. We've got some news from Point Central. We've got some updates from Beta about their open stores in Texas. And I'm going to be talking about the new August lock that's out in the market. Plus, this week, our guest is Jason Johnson, who is co-founder of August Home. And we're not actually talking about the new lock. We're talking about how he set up his home, which I thought you guys might find really interesting. And we'll also hear from Fairy, one of our sponsors. They're a platform for IoT. So let's just kick this off with a message from another one of our sponsors. This week's sponsor is Edge Impulse. New machine learning technology called TinyML and today's efficient 32-bit microcontrollers and CPUs are enabling real-time sensor and data insights. You can make use of 99% of sensor data that's discarded today, right on the edge. Edge Impulse is working with Google, ARM, ST, and others to make TinyML available to all developers and enterprises, enabling new high-value applications in machine monitoring, asset tracking, facility management, health, safety, and more. You can learn more and sign up for free at edgeimpulse.com. And I'm just going to interject here and say that I love TinyML, and I am super excited to have this company as a sponsor. So, all right. Let us get started with this week's show, subscriptions. Oh, my goodness. Last week, right after we finished our show, that Wednesday afternoon, Winx, our favorite hub that we love to hate because they basically just stopped working. They also stopped paying some of their people. And we've given up on it. But lo and behold, Winx was not dead. They rose from their sickbed and demanded $4.99 a month. And they only gave you a week in which to pay it. But
wait, I have to say it.
Okay.
Will, I am not happy about this.
Okay. I'm like, Will, I am not happy about this. I am not happy about this.
So a lot of people are not happy about this, according to the Winx user group on Facebook.
They will not, is what they're saying. Will, I am purchased Winx a while back. His investment fund, I should say. And this was after Quirky, the company that created Winx, they had their own problems. And they spun out Winx as a separate company. And we were all like, ooh, what's going to happen? And I think they actually had a separate owner in there. It was a retailer, I think, that owned them. But I can't remember that far back. And then Will.i.am's investment firm bought it. And Winx had kept trucking along until like kind of the end of 2018. And it just started getting real wonky. And then nothing really was getting updated. Things would break and no one would fix them. And then it came to light that people there weren't getting paid.
There was also no communication because I know you've reached out to the company countless times in the past year, year and a half.
And no one would talk to you. So, you know, we just were like, yeah, you know, we're not going to recommend this anymore. This is not a good product. It was a shame because it was a good product. But they got back in touch with us. They decided they needed a subscription fee. And I was surprised. In that email, they said they had 4 million users, which that's not too shabby. And people were pretty upset because Winx was like, yeah, you only get a week. I will say that yesterday, they did say that you now have 2 weeks in which to decide. And my hunch is they did this because everyone was pissed off and no one was subscribing.
Right. Here's the thing. We're used to subscriptions for services. So it's not like this is new, but when you purchased a Winx Hub, whether it was version 1 or version 2, at any point in the past 3-4 years, however long it's been around, there was no mention of this. There was no anticipation of this. And then only giving people a week, well, now 2 weeks, to make the decision really put a sour taste in a lot of people's mouth. And just to be clear, if you don't pay the subscription, the $5 per month, your Wink Hub will not work at all. You've lost control of everything you've set up. It's not like a value add service. This is to keep the product working.
People are calling it extortion. I tend to agree with them, although I will say that if you love your Wink, you now have 2 weeks to move it, or rather, you now have another week to move it. And if you don't see value in it going forward, then don't pay the subscription. Is it better or worse than just a company being like, yeah, we can't fund this anymore, so we're going to shut it down?
I mean, no, that's true.
That's the alternative.
That's very true. It's not like a hard shut off. And so that's good. But the question in my mind is how many people will subscribe to keep Wink afloat? Because I strongly suspect just hardware sales alone are not enough to keep the company viable. You're still taking a chance. You're hoping enough people join in with you to pay the $5 a month.
So I paid the $5 a month, not really because I think my Wink is all that. I unhooked everything from the Wink, but I was like, let's see where this goes. I'll hook it back up and see if I get new features or if it's just the same old, same old. But by doing it this way and by spending so long before making this decision, they really let the market run away from them. There's mm-hmm. not much I can do on my Wink that I can't do on like a Google or an Amazon or
SmartThings. Yeah.
So it feels like, you know, who's going to pay $5 a month for the functionality that Wink has had when they could get that for free in a lot of other places?
And they can also get a broader range of supported devices. I know from a SmartThings standpoint and certainly from a home assistant standpoint, although that's a different product.
That's a different market.
Agreed. But regardless, it's even just compared to SmartThings and mm-hmm. you have more products available to support it.
I will let you guys know as my Wink Hub either continues to work and if I find $5 a month worth it compared to all the other features I can get for free from other players.
And I would also love to know not just what you think, Stacey, but if we have any Wink Hub owners that listen to the show, are they going to stick with it, pay the $5, or are they moving on to something else? And what is that something else? I'd be very curious.
Yes. All right. In other subscription news. Oh, wait. Did we explain why we think the subscriptions need to happen? We should probably do this because every time we talk about subscriptions, someone's like, oh, I hate products that are subscriptions. And the reason this is because smart home products, they have costs associated with them. They have cloud costs. They have ongoing development and security patching. And it can be very hard to estimate that going forward, which is why we, call for people to set expiration dates for their devices so they're not stuck supporting something for 12 years if they don't want to. And B, think that you should probably consider subscription models in your business or really think hard about how that's going to work. Because a lot of companies put out products without thinking that far ahead, and we're seeing a real decimation in the landscape right now with companies dying because of this.
I would add, if you have a product coming to market without a subscription service, I would say commit to that model or state right up front that you do have a subscription service. Don't change it halfway through the product lifecycle.
Yeah, you could always add a subscription for a value-added service. I mean,
right.
I never understood why Wink didn't come out and say something to the effect of like, hey, you know, these features, pick a feature that maybe half of your audience is using or maybe 30% of your audience is using that they seem to be hardcore loving and charge them for that. Or build on that to, maybe it's just they did too much all at once. It was a really good hub. Okay.
No argument there. It was my favorite.
So back to value-added features and subscriptions. Nest has done this well. They launched their products, and when they started launching their video cameras, video is notoriously expensive on the cloud backend, they were like, hey, if you want to keep this for longer than a certain period of time, you're going to have to pay for it. And many people did. And now they are changing up their pricing. Kevin, what does it look like?
Right. So now, and we knew this was coming. They did announce a new Nest Aware plan or plans previously.
Last October.
I know it did take a long time. I don't know why, but it did. In any case, they are live now. I should specify also if you have a current Nest Aware subscription, you can keep that current plan for now. But the new ones, the Nest Aware $6 a month plan, or $60 a year, gives you 30 days of event video history, intelligent alerts, activity zones, creating and sharing clips, and it will include all the Nest camera speakers and displays in your home. So it's not a per camera or per device fee. If you would like a longer event video history, 60-day video history, with the addition of 10 days of 24x7 video history, which is, that's a lot, it's double the price. It's $12 a month or $120 per year. And again, it covers all of the devices in your home, has the same intelligent alerts, activity zones, creating, sharing clips, etc. So it depends, as you said, Stacey, how much video history you want, and or do you even want 24x7 video history?
Yeah, and that might make sense for like a small business who's using these cameras. I could see that being something I'd be after if I had, you know, right now in the pandemic, let's say I've got an office, put in a camera in there, that makes total sense. But for probably most people, the $6 a month seems reasonable.
I would think so. And to be honest, even though I have a Nest Hello doorbell, and that's the only Nest camera that I have, I am not going to change my subscription. I actually have the free service right now where I get 5 days worth of video history. Just that's what came out when the product was launched, and I just didn't feel like subscribing. So that's fine for me.
Yes, and we'll see how long you get that, Kevin.
Well, that's true. And to be honest, if you buy a new Nest camera now, you don't get that. You get 3 hours of clips included, and that's about it for free.
That's not awesome. I would like to see 24 hours. I mean, because a video doorbell, I've used a video doorbell without any subscription. For a while, Ring had it, so you had to buy a subscription to get any history, basically. So if you missed someone at your door, you were basically hosed. I just turned into a Canadian there. That was weird.
Okay.
But I didn't see the value in having a doorbell like that. Now, we'll talk about doorbells later on when we answer questions. So we'll get back to this meaty and exciting topic. But that's the new Nest Aware subscription. We also have, I'm going to say this is kind of a neat app. Google has launched a new voice assistant, an app to teach kids to read. And I obviously have a kid who is totally able to read. So this is not my bailiwick, but I love the idea of doing this. So they created a kid-focused assistant named Dia. Do you think it's Dia?
I would say Dia, D-I-Y-A.
So Dia is part of, they've got an educational app for Android called Read Along. And this app comes with a bunch of stories and word games for kids that are about 5 and up. And the little assistant hangs out on the screen. And it uses Google speech recognition tech to spot mistakes when the kid's reading. And it can, you know, just interact with them and be like, hey, that's great. And the student can ask Dia to pronounce words they don't know how to say. I love it.
Yeah, and it's the perfect time for this since currently a lot of kids are being homeschooled or, you know, just have parents that say, go read. It's perfect timing.
Yeah, and I remember when my daughter was learning how to read, we actually downloaded a couple apps on the iPad that did this, but you had to be there with her to make sure that she said it. And I'm not keen on like sending your children off to learn how to read by themselves, but you had to sit there with her as she played to make sure she did the things correctly. Because otherwise, sometimes she would be like, yes, I got it. Yes, I got it, when she didn't. And this has a natural corrective kind of thing with the speech recognition. And I'm actually kind of surprised it's taken this long, but I'm really excited about it.
Yeah, what's interesting to me, this actually developed from India.
Oh, yeah, it spoke Hindi.
Yes.
It's a Hindi app.
Yes, but now it's been expanded. The catalog of books, there's about 500 books in there, and Google says they're going to add more. I mean, it's really neat how sometimes we see, more often than not, everything comes out of the US from Google. But this actually originated in India and has expanded practically worldwide.
Yeah, so we just thought this was neat and worth drawing attention to because I think we don't always think about how cool AI can be, and we kind of tend to think of it as freaky and awful. But if you're trying to teach your kid how to read, good app to look into.
Yeah.
Okay. In other Google news, last Thursday when the podcast was live, but after we recorded it, Alphabet's Google Sidewalk said that it was going to not pursue its Toronto Quayside smart city plan. And this was a big deal.
You can talk like a Canadian now.
Oh, now maybe that's why I was getting all Canadian. In 2017, Alphabet, which is the parent company of Google, created Sidewalk Labs, which was its own company. And the idea was they were going to focus on smart cities and infrastructure. And what they did is they did an agreement with Toronto, the city of Toronto, to develop a waterfront area. And the idea was that, you know, they would improve mobility. They would have, like, I don't know, they did trash cans, smart trash cans. They were going to do pedestrian areas. And the whole idea was tech to help create a better community and sustainability. But what happened was Google came out with all these, like, razzmatazz cool plans, and people were like, oh, that sounds neat. And then there wasn't a lot of specifics in usual Google fashion. Mm-hmm. And then when people started asking about things like, hey, what's going to happen with the data? Google was like, oh, that's ours. And people were like, well, wait, we didn't agree to that. And then basically the citizens, a bunch of activists, they all were like, what about privacy? What about who owns the data? What are we actually giving up as part of this? What are we actually getting out of it? And it devolved into this big fight.
Mm-hmm.
And Google tried to address some of these concerns, but it did it in a very googly fashion. It stuck out, like, multi-thousand page plans that actually still didn't describe exactly what they were going to do, which didn't really assuage many people. And now my hunch is because of, and they said this in the, they blamed COVID-19. They were like, eh, we can't do this right now. It's the real estate market.
That's rather convenient.
What I will say, and I wrote this in the newsletter last week, is I do think that we're going to see a lot of projects that were, I don't want to call it vaporware, because I do think they were trying to do something, but they weren't real clear. There wasn't a lot of value that people could see from it. I think COVID-19 is going to really start separating the value add, like the true value add IoT projects from those that are just kind of fun. And this will be in the smart home. This will be in the enterprise. And this will be in, like, these big smart city efforts. And I think smart city efforts have always been a little more difficult to pursue because cities have limited budgets and they're answerable to their citizens. And so when you launch a digital transformation of your city, you really have to sell on what you can actually deliver.
You need buy-in from the public. It's interesting, and I didn't know this until I went back to the original press release back in 2017. This is a bigger deal by canceling it than I thought, because Sidewalk had committed $50 million to the initial phase. The federal, provincial, and municipal governments of Canada had a $1.25 billion investment to enable the waterfront project. I don't know if all of that disappeared by now. And Google was actually going to move their Canadian headquarters to this smart city. Obviously not happening there. Yep.
Not going to happen.
Not going to happen. Wouldn't be prudent.
So that's the Google news. We have, for all the makers and prototypers out there, a new Teensy board. Teensy boards are these tiny microcontrollers, and they come in different variations. There's Teensy 3s, 3-somethings. There's Teensy 4-somethings. And this is the latest, is the Teensy 4.1 development board. And the biggest change here is it has 10 to 100 megabit Ethernet, which is pretty darn fast.
Yeah, these, I believe, are Arduino capable, so, or compatible. So this would basically add some fast wired Ethernet to your Arduino project.
Yes. So, and it's got more pins if you're into that sort of thing. It's got 55 pins.
More pins are good.
More pins, more access to things, more connections. Yes. Oh, and it's got 8 megabytes of flash memory. Remember, these are microcontrollers, y'all. Teensy tiny microcontrollers.
Teensy little price, too, for what it is. It's $26.85, which is actually more than an Arduino board, but...
But it's got wired Ethernet.
I know.
Ah! Okay, so exciting for some people. Also, in little news from the IoT world... We missed this last week. I'm sorry about that. Point Central, which is a company that it's owned by Alarm.com, and they do apartment dwelling IoT stuff. And they acquired a company called DoorPort, and that's going to have them have smart intercom capability as part of the Point Central smart property management solution. And I don't know about you, but every time I go to an apartment and there's like an intercom thing, I'm like, why do I need to like punch a physical button? Why can't I do this over an app? Why is this old?
Well, because the apartment was built at a time when smart devices weren't readily available. Wi-Fi was probably just getting its legs. And
yeah, so this Doorport, their thing is their intercom is cellular based, so you don't have to wire it, so you can retrofit this. This is just a, you know, tiny little thing for people in that world, but it shows that slowly but surely we're making things smarter. Yay! There's also exciting news. We are opening up parts of the country. However you feel about that, it's happening. So Vibhu Norby, who is the CEO of Beta, the store, we've had him on the show a couple times. It's a store that you can go and play with all kinds of gadgets. They opened their Beta Austin and Beta Houston stores because Texas is open. And he posted some really cool numbers on Twitter about how many people showed up. So he said that during the work week, only 38 visitors went to the Austin store. That's off by more than 95%. He also said that weekend traffic doubled from the week prior, but it's still down by 90%. And this is what really got to me.
Here's the biggie. Yep.
The conversion rate on these people. So that means people who came in, did they buy something? It was 67% compared to 3% on average. So usually you go into the store, you browse, you touch, and you leave. But here, 2/3 of the people who went into the store bought stuff. So basically, it means that the people who I guess are going out to shop, they're going out with intent to purchase.
Yeah, I mean, you're not going out to browse these days. The only reason you're probably leaving home or going to the office and stopping somewhere on the way is because you need something or you think you need something. And that's great.
Yeah, so I was like, that's Austin, my former hometown. In Houston, where the store is in a mall, the Beta Austin is also in a mall, but it's an open-air Simon property, so you can park right in front of the store and get your stuff. So there, the conversion rate was only 14%. So I wonder if, like, people in Houston, it's also, well, I shouldn't say that Houston is a more conservative area. It's a larger area, which means there are more people who are probably conservative. So there were 138 people during the work week. It was still off by, there it was only 90%. And then the conversion rate there was so much lower.
That sort of makes sense to me because the Houston store is in an enclosed mall, correct?
Yes.
So people who are going to the mall to get whatever they need or want with intention, they're going to get something else and they happen to walk in the Beta store, fine, but they're not going there for the Beta store.
Yeah. So in that is true. So I just thought those were really interesting, and people were apparently buying last mile delivery vehicles, drones, and kitchen stuff. So that's what we know. Okay. And now let's talk about the new August lock,
which you have installed on your rental house.
I guess that long pause of Stacy going, let's talk about that, Kevin, because Kevin normally does our reviews. But you're right. I did this one.
Yeah, because Kevin has a smart lock and didn't have a deadbolt to attach the new August lock to.
Yes. Okay. So August lock, people in the lock industry get real snippy about this. Whenever I say August lock, they're like, it's a deadbolt turner. To which I'm like, all right, fine.
That's fair.
August lock does not replace your deadbolt. The August lock sits on top of your existing, pull out the plate on the inside of your door and you hook your deadbolt to a little turner, basically. And then you hook the August lock over that and then it turns your deadbolt for you. And this is really interesting for people who rent, because in rental units, you have to keep your old keys. This allows you to keep your old keys. It's an easier install for people who are intimidated by taking out a lock, which, by the way, don't be intimidated by taking out a lock.
It's easy.
It's super easy. The instructions are easy. The biggest challenge you're going to have with a lock is if you end up with like a weird depth, basically. Your
door thickness or
door thickness is a little
offset.
Off.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And the worst thing that's going to happen is you're going to try to put it on. It's not going to work. And you're going to spend another 7 minutes putting your old lock back on while you try to figure this out. My daughter, when she was like 11 or 10, changed our lock. So I just want people to be like, yeah, I could do that. Okay. So the August lock is $249.99. It is a Wi-Fi lock, so it is their first Wi-Fi lock, and this is the smallest Augustus lock out there. And they shrunk it by taking out the four AA batteries and replacing them with the, is it 123, CR123
batteries? CR123s, yep.
And there are two of those, so now it is smaller, and it looks just like the Augustus lock, so it's still this chunk of metal on your door that you can see from the inside. It's a nice lock, even though it's a deadbolt turner. It is expensive. Some people are like, yeah, I'm not going to upgrade from my existing lock because the existing Augustus locks that aren't Wi-Fi, they are bigger, but they have a bridge that brings them from Bluetooth to Wi-Fi. And if you already have that, I wouldn't switch because, as someone pointed out in the comments, that's wired power. So you aren't going to be changing the batteries as often. Jason Johnson, who is the co-founder of August Home, he says that the battery should last between 3 and 4 months, depending on usage. I mean, it really depends, because every time you engage that motor, you're sucking power. And Wi-Fi is power intensive compared to Bluetooth. And there's a Wi-Fi lock by Array, which that was actually one of the first Wi-Fi locks out on the market, and that's by Hampton. They make Brinks stuff as well. So Wi-Fi locks have been kind of a trend that are coming on, and that's because people want the ability to open their lock remotely, and Bluetooth doesn't have that ability unless you buy a bridge. So back to the August lock. It's expensive. It's pretty. If you like that modern aesthetic, if you do not like the modern aesthetic, you're going to be like, what the heck is this giant blob on my door? And it's got some fun features. So it still uses Bluetooth and it auto-unlocks when you get close to it. There is no keypad. So if you are wandering around without your phone or your keys, you are not going to be able to get into the door.
Yeah.
You're going to have to knock and someone will have to let you in. So that's something to think about for people like me who wander around without their phone. If you have your phone, though, it should read it and open your door, just like, you know, your car. When you get near your car, your door locks pop open, usually. That's not Bluetooth. That's something else. But the idea is the same. And, you know, the August app is a good experience. It integrates with HomeKit. It integrates with Amazon Echo and Google Assistant. And it works really well. So, you know, if you're shopping for a lock and you don't want a keypad, I'm pro keypad, but if you don't want a keypad, this is a good option. Or if you're a renter, this is a great option if you're a renter.
Yeah, because this is a lock you can take with you. You're not damaging anything on the existing door. I think it's perfect for that. I think it's probably best suited for those people. I gotta be honest, I'm not a fan of those smaller batteries and having to buy them every 4 or 5 months. I know most lock makers don't want you to use rechargeables, but I actually do. And they last me a good 6 months.
Oh, that's interesting. Yeah, August does say that you shouldn't use rechargeables, but if you're using them and they're working.
Well, plus they're a standard size. Not that CR123s aren't standard, but they're not as ubiquitous as a AA, AAA, etc. And AAs are what my Nest by Yale uses.
Got it. Okay, so that's the August lock experience. If you have questions or anything, you know, give us a shout. And now we are moving into the part of the show where we answer your questions. This is the IoT Podcast Hotline, and this week it is sponsored by Schlage. The best home automation adds convenience, not hassle. With its built-in Wi-Fi, the Schlage Encode Smart Wi-Fi Deadbolt shows just how easy secure can be. Learn more at schlage.com. All right, and this month, if you call us, you will be entered to win a Schlage lock or a Helium hotspot. You will have a choice, because I know that not everybody wants a LoRaWAN hotspot. Although,
I do.
Yes, Kevin does. Kevin's like, he's calling the hotline all the time. So, to call us, you will call us at 512-623-7424. And you will be entered to win either of those prizes. This week's question is from two people. We have two people who are asking, basically, they're building new houses, and they want to know what we think. So we're going to hear one of their questions.
Hi, Stacy. This is Tyler in Akron, Ohio. In the process of building a new house, and I have a Google Home environment planned with indoor cameras, outdoor cameras, the doorbell, some Hub Home Maxes, And I'm wondering, what else am I missing? Oh, I'm thinking I'm doing Lutron switches to kind of automate that kind of stuff. But in the grand scheme of things, what else should I be thinking about to make sure I get it set up right?
Okay. This is a great question, because I'm currently facing it too, although I'm not building a brand new house. I'm buying an old house. But I'm very excited about thinking about all the things I can finally put back in my house. It's fun. If you are building a new house, our first recommendation is get your foundations right and not your actual foundation, although that's important.
That would be good too, yes.
We're talking about a LAN. You should have wired Ethernet in more places than you think. And I know people are like, you could do without it, but I love my wired Ethernet.
It's nice to have. I mean, mesh networking is great, but it's really handy to just plug something into the network if it's capable of being plugged in. So, yes.
Exactly. And when I built my house, I used Cat6 cable throughout, and I actually put Ethernet in every room. That may be overkill, but I would definitely put Ethernet in your office area near your, I'll call it the server closet, or maybe it's the server shelf in your house. So probably down somewhere in the center of your home. And also wherever you're going to have televisions.
Yes, that's a must.
So maybe you don't need it in the bathroom.
Did you put one in the bathroom?
No, I did not.
Okay, just checking.
I think I did put some in my laundry room, and now I don't know why. Oh, another area where you may want it, and this is a little weird, is your garage.
Yes.
And I say that because you may want to set up a camera there. I don't know about you, but my car gets regular wireless updates. So, you know, having a good Wi-Fi connection down there is kind of nice as well. Okay, so once you've established your basic foundation of good Ethernet and good internet coverage everywhere, it's time to pick an ecosystem. And this could be HomeKit, it could be Google, it could be Madam A, and you might do HomeKit plus a voice. It's your call.
Plus a voice, meaning you're not a fan of Siri? I am not.
She's getting better.
No argument.
Plus, HomePods are expensive.
They are indeed.
And if you're not all in on Apple, you know, that's... anyway, okay. So pick your ecosystem. I recommend if you can stomach it, if you're doing it Apple or Google or HomeKit, you know, you can have an iPad in there for a display, but have a display somewhere in your house. And I say this because it's nice sometimes to poke things and not shout at them.
And because I know we're going to talk about another item you should consider, it's really handy to have displays around the house if you have video doorbells.
Oh, yes. All right, so we decided the things you probably most are thinking about is lights, a thermostat. You may not think about a thermostat, but the energy savings there can be pretty awesome, so I recommend you start thinking about that. Locks, doorbell cameras, and camera cameras. And after that, there's a long list of things like leak sensors that you're probably going to want to think about. But going down the lists, since you're building new, I'm going to say you should do light switches, and I'm going to recommend Lutron because I always recommend Lutron. And I do so because the hub will work with HomeKit, Google, and Amazon. It's an $80 hub. It will work with all your switches. Lutron just works. And if later on you want to do something crazy with your shades, you can use the Serena shades and they will all work together. So I love the experience. I love the extensibility of it. And it is more expensive. The Lutron switches are going to run you, but if you're building a house, you can wrap all that up in your
life. I was just going to say, you just wrap it all up in the mortgage and be done with it.
For your thermostat, Kevin, what'd we decide?
I am a fan of the Ecobee. It was among the first to have the remote sensors, which are nice to have. Like my Ecobee thermostat is downstairs, but sometimes it's too hot or too cold upstairs. So we have a remote sensor that monitors the temperature upstairs as well, and you can add additional ones. But it's not the only one that has remote sensors. I know the Nest products, the Nest thermostats now have remote sensors. I think a 3-pack of those are $99 if you want to add those to a Nest thermostat.
Yes. So either of those we think are probably pretty good for you. It doesn't matter which ecosystem you're in. Totally. And Ecobee does have a HomeKit enabled one. Nest does not. You have to do some work there. So if you're in a HomeKit house, maybe not Nest. Okay. Locks. Here... again, ecosystem doesn't really matter. So I would think about the things that matter to you in a lock. Do you want Wi-Fi? Do you want a keypad? I say you always want a keypad.
Yes, you do.
You always want a keypad. Let's just be honest here. So, you know, most locks, what happens is you buy a lock and it has a keypad. In the case of August or Wise, both of those locks are the deadbolt turners. Those don't have a keypad, but you can buy it a one that works with them. So that's really a personal preference. I would look at the fits and finishes of the locks. Since this is sponsored by Schlage, you know, you are now entered to win a Schlage lock, so maybe that'll happen for you. It's a good lock. And let's see, doorbell cameras, Kevin.
Well, because I chose Google as my digital assistant ecosystem, I have a Nest Hello camera, as I mentioned earlier, and it's worked really, really well for me. And I, again, as I said, I don't pay the subscription fee because I don't need tons and tons of storage data, etc. So that's what I use.
Got it. And we also recommend the Eufy security video doorbell, unless you're a HomeKit house. But if you're not a HomeKit house, this works with Google and Madam A, and it is subscription-free. It's one of the few ones out there that is subscription-free. The Wirecutter loved it, and it's got local storage, too. It's cheaper. So
yeah, that's much cheaper than the Nest Hello, which uses cloud-based storage. This is $160 for the Eufy, and it has 4 gigabytes of local storage built in.
All right, and then when it comes to cameras, if it is important to see things on your display and you've chosen your ecosystem, you can do things like Nest Cams, but they are expensive. And I actually am going to recommend for your indoor cameras, the $30 Wyze Cams. It's a no-brainer. You can control them with Amazon Echo and Google, but there's a little bit of a delay. I don't know if you can see them from the displays.
Yeah, you can see them from the displays. Like I will say, you know, hey, G, show me the driveway, because that's the name of the Wyze camera that faces out front of my house. And there is a delay. It does work, but there is a delay.
But they're cheap, like $30.
And your data isn't going to the cloud. So from a privacy standpoint, if that's something you're more comfortable with, it has local storage capabilities. It doesn't come with it. It comes with a micro SD card slot that you have to fill with a micro SD card.
And then for outdoor cameras, Wyze is making one, but it's not on the market yet. They're talking about having it come out in June. So if you're keen and need one of those, Ring, which works pretty seamlessly with Amazon stuff, or Nest, which works seamlessly with Google stuff, or you can go with something like the Arlo outdoor cams, which I have, and they're quite good. And they work with those other systems, but there is a bit of a delay. So that's the outdoor camera. And then here's the deal. When you build your home, you're probably going to be thinking like, oh, and I could do this and I can do that. And I would recommend getting some water detection, so leak detection. I think if you're building a new home, you should actually look at something like the Flow by Moen, or the Fin system that hangs out on a water meter and can do leak detection that way. I also would recommend doing something like Honeywell water sensors that, you know, you can just throw around like next to your water heater or your washer and just detect leaks there. So those are some other things that you might think about. Kevin,
I have one more. I do, and I'm surprised you skipped it. It's your favorite.
Yeah. Oh, what is it?
Smart faucet.
Oh, the smart faucets. Yes, everybody has smart faucets now, and they're super fun. I will say there's two ways to think of a smart faucet. One is you can talk to like Madam A or Google and tell it to turn on your faucet and to dispense a certain amount of water. And that is awesome. But there's also just a simple capacitive touch faucet, which is like just like magic. I love that thing. And in this time of COVID, you still have to touch it to make it work. So maybe you want the voice activated one. But I love it so much. I miss it so much. My current house doesn't have one. And it's like one of the first things I'm buying for my new house.
I'm surprised you didn't mention it.
Yeah, I was remiss. So those are some ideas for you to get your house a little bit smarter. Oh, and we forgot the garage door. You should totally stick. There's the MyQ. MyQ is pretty much the biggest game in town, and they do have HomeKit, Google, and Amazon compatibility. But this is just so you can see that your garage door is closed, and if it's not closed, you can open it. This is especially great for people who are worried about like, oh my God, did I close the garage door? Or who have kids who don't close the garage door and you would like to just get a notification if it's been open for too long.
That's how I have mine set up. So that way it will tell me if I've left it open for more than, I think I have it set for 15 minutes. I probably need to shorten that. But that way I can say, oh, I left the house and left the garage door open. I can just hit a button and close it.
Voila. 15 minutes is fine unless you live in a neighborhood where like there are marauders.
No, it's not Mad Max out here yet.
All right. Well, that is our answer for you guys about building a new home, what to think about. Choose your ecosystem, build your foundation, and then have fun. And if you want to call to be entered to win a Schlage-Lock or a Helium Hotspot, give us a call at 512-623-7424, and we'll try to get to you on the show. And that concludes this portion of the show, but please stay tuned for our guest, Jason Johnson, who is going to tell us actually how he set up his smart home. And now, a message from our sponsor. This week's sponsor is Very. Hey everyone, we are taking a quick break from the Internet of Things podcast for a message from our sponsor. This week's sponsor is Very, an IoT development services firm. And I have Bill Brock, the VP of Engineering, here to talk to me. Hi, Bill. How are you today?
Hey, Stacy. Thanks. I'm doing great.
Excellent. All right. We're going to talk today about how Very worked with a company called Hop to build the world's first self-serve beer kiosk that uses facial recognition technology. So can you start off by telling me, how does that work?
Sure. Hop asks first-time users to enter basic personal information, scan an image of their ID, take a few photos of their face, and swipe their credit card. When pouring a beer, a photo is taken at the tap and compared to the user's reference images, giving a match rating out of 100%. Bartender on site then reviews the rating and approves or denies the service. On future visits, customers are automatically recognized, which means all they have to do is approach the kiosk, choose a tap, and pour a beer.
Awesome. So what did Very do to help?
The founder of Hop approached us with a working product that was up and running, but it was honestly really difficult to use and pretty buggy. We did an audit of the existing software and identified a lot of improvements we could make. For example, the previous system could only control 2 taps at a time, but we implemented a system that could handle 8. On the software side, we quickly built and integrated facial recognition technology utilizing AWS's recognition service. And we also rebuilt the rest of the existing software so that it could be more easily customized for the company's needs. And to get the hardware and software to work together, we used Nerves, an open source IoT embedded development framework. Using Nerves, we were able to develop firmware for controlling the tap and measuring how much beer is poured. We moved to a cloud-managed approach for managing all screens and hardware connections. We implemented rolling updates for all deployed hardware and also enabled real-time interactions between the hardware and software. The end result was truly very impressive and led the way for us to tackle even more interesting and challenging projects with Nerves.
Awesome. So can you tell me a little bit more about Nerves?
Sure. Nerves is an open-source development framework for building out embedded applications using Elixir. Nerves enables us to build, deploy, and securely manage fleets of IoT devices at speed and scale. At Very, we love to use IoT and machine learning to bring unique ideas to life, whether that's on the consumer side, like this project, or the industrial side.
Great. So, Bill, where can I go to learn more about how Very can help me with my IoT projects?
When it comes to IoT, the Very team has done it before, and we can do it for you. If you're interested in similar results on your IoT project, please reach out to us at verypossible.com/Stacy. That's verypossible.com/STACEY.
Hey, everyone. Welcome back to the Internet of Things podcast. This is your host, Stacey Higginbotham. And today's guest is Jason Johnson, who is the co-founder of August Home, which was purchased by the parent company of Yale Locks. Hi, Jason. How are you today?
I'm great, Stacey. Nice to be with you.
Likewise, and I feel like we've had a super long history. When did you found August?
2012, and I think you're one of the early journalists we talked to.
Yeah, so that was fun and exciting. So it's been a long time, and we're not here actually to talk very much about August. We're actually here to talk about your smart home setup, because I think people right now are bored, willing to spend some time doing some projects that otherwise they may have decided not to do. So I wanted to talk about what you have in your home. So let's get started with a quick sense of, so broadly, what do you have in your smart home? What's your organizing, not principle necessarily, but company?
Well, you know, I had some various principles and goals I wanted to achieve. One, I wanted it to be products that could be just purchased off the shelf, right? That I could install myself, because, well, when you make products that are DIY, you should use them yourself. And I knew I'd have journalists come to my home and see the house, and I wanted to have all things people could just buy from, you know, Best Buy or Walmart or Amazon, Apple stores, and take home and install. And I wanted them to be affordable things too, right? People that have the resources can have a Control 4 system or Crestron, but I wanted my house to look like something that, you know, really anybody could have. And then beyond that, in terms of like the actual technology and solutions, I had some key goals towards that. And would you like me to share what those are?
I would. Tell me your principles behind your smart home.
Yeah. So in choosing the actual, you know, products and technologies, I wanted first and foremost, everything to look good in the house, or even better, disappear, right? Because you spend a lot of time in your house. And I think the more simple the environment is, the more warm and inviting it is. So I didn't want lots of lights, you know, blue and red and green lights all over the place and shiny plastic boxes. I wanted things to either disappear or stand out because they're beautiful and they're part of the decor. Secondly, I wanted to make sure that everything was built with energy reduction in mind. How can you reduce consumption of energy through the various systems in the house? And then thirdly, I wanted everything in the house to be as future-proof or resilient as possible. And we can definitely talk about what that looks like. We can talk about platforms and the actual technologies.
Just to keep people guessing, before we get to which platforms you're using, let's take those principles one by one. I'm going to start with the most controversial. Let's talk about future-proofing, because right now I think people are feeling pretty burned. We've had Google flop Works with Nest into like Google. We've had the Sonos debacle. We've had a couple things shutting down recently. So when you're looking for future-proof, talk to me about what that means to you.
Well, it meant, you know, if I have dozens and dozens of things installed in my house, that they would work, even if the company behind it or the service behind it was shut down or something went wrong. I wanted to be as resilient as possible to that. And so I had concerns about a lot of the platforms out there. And, you know, sorry to throw, you know, companies, you know, under the bus here, but, you know, companies like Wink, right, you know, shutting down. I have concerns about the viability of things like SmartThings, right? It's, you know, it's not a core business of Samsung. So they may at some point decide they don't want to invest in it any longer. I'd say similarly with the Nest platform, the Google Nest platform. You got to ask yourself, does the Google Nest system, does it help Google sell more advertising? Is it core to their business? Will they support it long term? I don't know. Right? I don't think any of us know. But then you look at, you know, the Amazon platform, and we have to look at what is the business model there. And in my opinion, it's a platform that is trying to help them sell more stuff and create more of a relationship with consumers to sell more stuff. And so perhaps their platform fits with their business model. Even more so, I'd say Apple's platform. I'd say that HomeKit probably helps Apple sell more devices. And so therefore it is core to their business. And it's something they'll probably support as long as they make devices, which they probably will make for a long time. So for me, those last two were the more comfortable ones for me, and believing that both the Amazon platform and the HomeKit platform would persist.
Wow. Okay. So you have chosen the Amazon platform and Apple's HomeKit. And had you always been an iPhone user?
I have been, yeah. I'm a big fan of the Google Nest products and the Android products. I personally think that the Nest cameras and the AI processing behind them is the highest quality in the industry, and I can, you know, I can rave on about all the great things that Android does that iOS doesn't. But yes, my household, we are heavy Apple product users, and so HomeKit, you know, fit very well within our usage.
Okay, yes, because that's one commonality. I'm like, oh. If you've been on Apple, HomeKit is a wonderful platform. And if everyone in your house is on Apple, it's very easy to be like, yeah, we're going to stick with this.
And that was one of the reasons why I also wanted to have a secondary platform. And the Amazon one is that secondary platform, because if somewhere down the line, you know, we choose to switch to becoming Android users, yes, we would lose perhaps the HomeKit functionality, but we would still have the Amazon platform we can use in our, you know, our voices and routines throughout the house.
Sure. And there you might have to choose a different hub. Do you have devices that require hub connections? Like, and I'm thinking having Z-Wave, Zigbee, all these alternative communication protocols. Are you using any of them for sensors or anything?
Unfortunately, the answer is yes. I have had to use a couple of bridges. Now, I should mention that just like when I created the company August, I honed in on Bluetooth and Wi-Fi as RF technologies that I believed would be pervasive in the home. Near term and long term. Those other RFs, you know, Zigbee, Z-Wave, and others, I've always had concerns about their long term viability, and so I've tried to avoid having to have anything that uses those. However, there was one product, and only one product, that I couldn't get away from with Zigbee, and that was the dog door. I wanted a dog door that we could lock and unlock, and I could only find one with Zigbee. Everything else I found, you know, every module in the house has Wi-Fi. That Zigbee module, but it does require me to have a SmartThings hub, which is great, and I'm a fan of SmartThings. It works very well.
Aha. So as we dig deeper into your smart home, we find out that it's a little more complicated, which is often the case.
Yes.
So, okay, let's go back to your core principles, and then we'll dive into what your home actually looks like. You also mentioned that things should be energy efficient. Does this mean that you're looking at energy consumption of the devices you have? Because, you know, every single one of these devices either has a battery or is powered, or are you thinking more on terms of like reducing energy in your house?
Yeah, so I wanted to target the big energy consumption items first, mainly, you know, lighting and heating and air conditioning. And so, you know, that really required thinking through, you know, both occupancy and vacancy of rooms and not lighting or heating or cooling a room that's not occupied. That was by far the biggest. But I like how you mentioned there's a lot of things that we have in our home that are just power vampires that aren't really doing anything other than just existing because they're, you know, there's little transformers. And I do have a whole bunch of switches to power down those things as well when they're not being used, so they're not absorbing any energy when they're in that sort of passive mode.
So you mentioned earlier beauty, and beauty is very subjective. You're probably not a fan, it sounds like, of glossy white plastic boxes. How well do you think the industry is doing when it comes to making devices that are beautiful? I feel like we're still stuck in this Apple aesthetic, I'll call it for lack of a better word, which is, you know, very Apple-esque packaging, again, glossy, shiny, white orbs, boxes, those kind of things. How's the industry doing with variation, different aesthetics, overall attention to that?
Well, there's certainly many companies trying very hard to make their products look as attractive as possible. And I certainly applaud those efforts. It's not easy, right? Especially when you have something that has to be visible, you can't just put it in a cabinet or hide it away. Including a door lock, right? You know, when we're making the August lock, you know, we spend a lot of time trying to figure out how to make it as attractive as possible because it's something you're going to see every day, multiple times a day. It's right there. You know, I think we did a great job, but we could have done better. I'll be first to admit that the August smart lock in the first three generations, you know, it's of quite a significant size. It's, you know, it looks like a fairly large hockey puck on your door.
And it is chunky.
I'm very excited. it's a bit chunky. You know, it's a lot going on inside of there. But I'm very excited about this fourth generation lock that we just launched. And if you haven't seen it, I highly encourage people to go to Best Buy when you can, or Apple stores and see it and touch it and feel it. It's dramatically smaller, and I think looks a lot better.
It is dramatically smaller, and it is a pretty lock for people who, again, appreciate that modern aesthetic. Let us go back into your home and how it's set up. You have more than 100 devices in your home, correct?
I do, yeah. For better or worse, I do.
It's very, very exciting. So let's talk about how does everything have to support both Amazon and HomeKit?
That is the goal. Now, you know, HomeKit devices aren't, you know, nearly as pervasive as all the non-HomeKit devices that are out there. So there are definitely some exceptions of things that don't support HomeKit today. And we can talk about how I deal with those. But everything does support the Amazon platform 100%. So I got that basis covered.
Okay. So talk to me about how you use HomeKit and then how you use Amazon.
So,
like, where do you do your routines?
Yeah, exactly. So first and foremost, automation, right? Those routines. So the most interaction that's happening in my house is fully automated, right? It's, you know, you walk up to the front door, it unlocks, lights turn on. When you leave, door locks automatically, lights turn off, thermostats turn down. At nighttime, you know, at a certain time, everything powers down, doors lock. At certain times of the day, you know, shades go up or down based upon where the sun is, to reduce the heating inside of the house. And so a lot of what happens is just fully automated, and that's the best. I truly believe that the best smart home is a home that just is smart. It just does what it's supposed to do, and you as the user, as the family, don't have to do anything. But to your question on what actual interactions we do, you know, with quite a few voice commands. So we all use voice commands to open and close the pool cover, to start movie time, which kicks off a whole routine of things that gets us ready to watch TV in the evening. So voice, and then last is that actual physical interaction with an app, right? We all have iOS devices, so the Home app is pretty available to us. But I'd say, you know, that's more the exception, that we go to our phones, we go to our Apple Watches and actually press the button. It's again more like we're going to use our voice in a given room.
I should ask, do you have a HomePod?
It's funny. I do have one. I don't need it because I have built-in speakers everywhere in the house. So using the Amazon platform is very easy. But I do have one HomePod because I'm always testing things and I'm always looking to see how Apple's evolving Siri to make it, you know, smarter. And it's coming along. It's getting better.
Okay. So yes, there's one, but it's not a day-to-day use kind of thing at this moment in time. Maybe one day.
Yeah, I will say, though, I do enjoy the more natural language of communicating with that HomePod when I'm trying to command something specific in the house. When you have 138 nodes, trying to remember the exact syntax when you're talking with the Amazon platform is challenging. I find that the HomePod with Siri, I can just more naturally refer to a particular object, and it will control that object.
For people who don't spend a lot of time with either of the platforms, or one or the other, can you give me an example of how you might command Madam A to do something versus Lady S? I don't know. I don't know what to call her without setting her up.
Yeah, so we're in Napa, and you know, there's a lot of sun here, so we have a lot of window coverings. I think there's at least it's somewhere between 30 and 40 Lutron Serena shades. So trying to remember what is the exact name of each shade is pretty challenging, right? If you want to lower a particular shade in a particular room. And it's hard to remember those using the Amazon platform. But again, with Siri, it's pretty easy. I can just say, hey, Siri, lower the south shades in the master bedroom. I don't have to know. I could say that. I reverse the order of that, and she would get it either way. Very, very natural language.
Got it. Okay. Makes sense, as opposed to remembering this is shade number one in the master bedroom, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
Naming is hard. I'll tell everyone, you know, you'll put a lot of thought into it, or maybe you won't put any thought into it, and then later you have to come back and fix it. But sometimes you put thought into it, and then you still have to come back and fix it. Oy.
Yeah, you know.
Okay, so let's go back to your controlling your 138 nodes. How do you find I find that setting up routines in HomeKit is very easy. And do you use HomeKit and Madam A? Do you set up routines in both of those? Do you do the same thing for every device, but you do it twice?
So it's funny you asked this, because I did something the other day, and this is a little bit morbid, but it's, you know, it's the reality we're all living in right now. I actually wrote down some notes in Evernote. My wife and I share an Evernote database, and I had to write some notes down so that these routines that I've created, because I have them both in the Amazon platform and I have them in the HomeKit. And I don't want her, you know, for some reason, if I'm not available to tell her, you know, where these things that are automatically happening, where what's controlling them, I want a place where she could find out. Because I do have a couple of routines in each, mainly because of the voice control. So the ones that are 100% automated by time, by schedule, or by sensors, I have those in the Home app. And then those that are controlled by voice routines, I have those in the Amazon app.
Got it. And that is, yes, it's morbid, but I have a similar list for people. Mostly because I used to travel so often, and I'd get these phone calls like at odd times. Why is this happening? Make it stop happening. So how much time do you think you spend working on your smart home a week? Let's talk about like setup process. Is it, you know, an hour for each new device to bring it into the home and bring it into a routine and automations? Or how should we think about the time investment here?
Well, let me first of all say that it's far more than probably most of us that are DIYers realize, right? So my house was just finished being constructed. It was done almost a 5-year overall project. So it was just completed within the past year. And so since we moved in, yes, I've been tweaking and tailoring everything. And then something new shows up, right? Some new device. Yeah, I'd say I'm sure I spend at least, you know, 5 to 10 hours a week either fixing things or adding things, which is a pretty big amount of my free time.
It's a good thing that also relates so heavily to your day job.
Indeed. It is part of my responsibility to understand how all these systems work and make sure that August plays well with all of them.
Okay. So with this in mind, what advice would you give to people who are like, all right, this is inspiring. I'm going to go set up a home on either of these platforms.
I often encourage people to really think through what problems are they trying to solve. I mean, you can just do things for fun, right? That's great. But again, recognize it may be a lot of time consumed. But there's plenty of things you could do that are going to give great satisfaction not only you, but also to your whole family. I think those things that provide peace of mind and comfort. I'm biased, but you know, having your door automatically locked at night, every night at a certain time, that gives a certain amount of peace of mind. Having lights come on, go off automatically, it's really enjoyable. And on lights, I might add, yes, I have lots of smart light switches throughout the house, but I also have some pretty dumb switches. And what I mean by dumb is they're not connected. I'm a big fan of vacancy switches. I believe that you should always have a vacancy light switch in any room that you don't want a light to be on for more than, you know, a certain amount of time. Like a pantry or any of your closets. We walk into those rooms in my house and the light comes on automatically, which is great when your hands are full going into the pantry or going out of the pantry, and then it turns off automatically.
Yeah, that was one of my favorite things that I did in my house. I had it in my laundry room, which was a great place to have it.
So one thing I really would encourage people to do is try some things that pushes maybe your comfort level. Believe it or not, switching on a light switch is not very difficult. It's you can do it far faster than you might think. And so long as you know where the breaker switch is, you can turn off the breaker. You know, it's really easy to pull out a light switch and throw in a smart one. Obviously, with locks as well, far easier than you might think. Even the thermostat. There are exceptions on thermostats, but for a large majority of homes, you know, they have a very simple, just two or three wires. Pretty easy to swap out a thermostat.
Agreed. All right. Well, Jason, thanks so much for coming on the show this week. We really appreciate it.
My pleasure. It's always fun talking shop with you, Stacey. I know that you've lived with a lot of these products and platforms like I have, and it's been fun comparing that with you over the years.
That's it for this week. Thanks so much for listening. And remember, if you'd like more IoT news, sign up for my newsletter at stacyoniot.com. We'll see you next week.